Sports, wine, life. This is the Macko and Cause podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Macko and Cause podcast, the Saturday weekend edition of the pod where our clothes are a lot more, I was going to say casual, but Bob, I am wearing pants and a belt.
Are you really wearing a belt? Because it's 10 after 10 in the morning on Saturday.
Yeah. Well, I've already been to the St. Lawrence Market. I had to pick some stuff up, and I like to go super early because this is the first time I've been in any sort of store on a Saturday. So I wanted to get in and out as possible. And I'm not a monster. I'm still going to wear a belt.
Okay. So two things. First of all, a cool family fact. My brother-in-law is the manager of St. Lawrence Market. Totally interesting job.
Really?
Second, yeah. Yeah, Dan Pacheco. He runs it for the city because it's a city thing.
Yeah.
And I guess, I don't know how the hierarchy breaks down, but to the best of my knowledge, he pretty much runs the joint. So, yeah, super. And he's a super foodie. You've been to Dan's place. He's an incredible cook.
Yeah.
No, it's a perfect job for him. Second thing, the fact that you had somewhere to go Saturday morning doesn't explain why you wore a belt on your way there.
Yeah, for my pants. You know, I can't now wear a belt.
Did you just lose 30 pounds? They don't fit?
No, they fit fine. They're a little loose, but even if they weren't, I always just wear a belt.
But it's Saturday morning.
I know.
But then again, I guess you don't have any other pants. Do you even own jeans?
I wear a belt with jeans.
You wear a belt with jeans?
Yeah.
Do you have rich guy sweaters? You know when rich guys are sitting on the dock and they've got their casual sweater that says, I'm going to postpone the eviction till tomorrow?
No, I've never been a big sweater guy because I'm a climate denier. So like even when the weather's cold, I never dress properly. I have like about three sweaters and I would define them all as they're fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're not great. They're fine.
I remember going into Hugo Boss to buy some dress shirts. I guess, no, not Hugo Boss, Harry Rosen. And I looked at the sweaters and I thought, who on God's green earth would wear these things? They look like three or four rugs were fighting at once and got all tangled up.
Oh, yeah. Ugh.
Anyway, the other thing.
Yeah.
Both Dan and, yep, no, we covered both things.
I just want to give a quick shout out to Dan. The St. Lawrence Market is run brilliantly. It is always very clean, efficient. It's never that packed. I know I'm spending a little bit more, but at the very least, it's local. And it's not as crowded as other grocery stores. So I don't feel any of that anxiety that where everyone is trying to play that COVID dance with each other. So I love the market.
There are things our city doesn't do so well. Something it does do well is St. Lawrence Market. I'm quite proud of him that he's part of that. I wanted to mention,
yeah, that's great.
We were chatting a little bit before we started, very little because we do almost no pre-discussion. These are in the moment conversations, but I was mentioning to you that Charlotte finally got to see a friend in person yesterday, and it was a huge family moment for us.
Yeah, that's great. How, like, go into detail. I mean, you were telling me before that, like, a lot of kids, video conferencing, that can only satisfy you so much.
It's a blessing that it exists and a curse that it exists. A blessing in the sense that she's been able to sort of keep up with some friends. A curse in the sense that it starts to feel like a replacement for actual contact. And then you remember weeks down the road, oh, no, it isn't. So it's almost a placebo when you actually need medicine. Her little buddy, Francis McAllister. Francis came over with her mom, Sheila. They sat in the yard. We all socially distanced. Charlotte and Francis played badminton. And you used to be a badminton player, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
That's a little on brand for you. But anyway. No, it was great. It was really great. And then in the evening, we went and we sat in a friend's yard. And everybody's worked really hard to keep their distance. Even now, it was just good. You know, Matt, it was good. It was one of a tiny moment of joy in a very difficult 2020, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like the few times. That's awesome. I mean, the few times when you see someone, it is. It's now almost exciting. You know, and it's that weird moment when you go for a hug and you can't hug and you're like, what the hell's going on here? But it's still damn good.
That's not the hardest moment, but I find it's the most, revealing moment, the moments where you would hug someone, but you can't. Although apparently, yeah, according to the Ontario government, we've got a small bubble of people we can hug.
Yeah, it's like 10 or something now. Feels like The Bachelor, you know.
There's four people I wouldn't hug anyway, so I guess I'm just going to like... I'm just going to have to explain up front, look, like, I can, but I won't.
I can, but I choose not to.
Conscientious objector. Speaking of which, I want to dive into sports today. It's another day where politics and sports intermingle in surprising ways.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to talk about Kyrie Irving and the Zoom calls yesterday and the fact that Kyrie Irving has become the face of dissent when it comes to starting up the NBA. What do you think about this, Matt?
I'm just starting to read it now. Like, on one part, it seems to, like, it's a very legit point. Like, I don't want to do sports because that might take the momentum away from the protests. But then I'm hearing other stories that, you know, he was commenting on sitting in the stands or saunas or all of this other stuff. And so, like, Kyrie Irving's always a tricky one because often I bet the message is good, but the messenger is flawed.
I don't know Kyrie Irving personally, but I've been interested in his career since he was drafted out of Duke. One, because you know, you love basketball, you know he's going to be great. But he also doesn't seem like a conventional anything. I think your analysis is really good there, where it's hard to listen to him because we've gotten used to tuning him out or putting kind of quotation marks around everything he says. What I find really interesting about this, Matt, is... it was calls amongst the PA and a lot of players. And I guess what the report I read, so there was about 20% of the league was on this giant Zoom call. And one of the people conspicuous by his absence was LeBron James, who has been pretty vocal, I imagine, a lot, you know, internally and even publicly about, you know, he wants to start things up and get things going.
Yeah.
And this, to me, between Kyrie Irving and LeBron, like, take all the Cleveland drama out of it. It's a fascinating two worldviews. You've got the LeBron James who says, you know, you work within the system and use it to make your point in order to fix the system. And then you've got the Kyrie Irving. Well, don't you have to shut it down so that we don't lose ourselves in the distraction and focus on the things right in front of us right now? And here's the thing. They're both right.
Oh, yeah. Like, you can, in a lot. Yes, sir.
No. I was just going to say you can make a great case, depending on what you believe in your heart, for both ways of looking at it.
I agree. And now, you know, even though I think Kyrie is not the best messenger, you know, the message out there is less talking and more just listening to people that don't look like you and I. So I'm all here for listening to what he's saying. And you're right. Both sides work. Like, LeBron James wants to play. He's part of it. He's motivated because he's older and he doesn't have many chances. Yes. But LeBron also last week helped to spearhead a group to make sure there isn't voter suppression in African-American communities in Atlanta, and doing what he can to make sure that if you are poor and you want to vote, he'll help. He's with a group to make sure that everyone can vote. And that, I mean, more than almost anything else we talk about is policy change. And LeBron's trying to do that. So, you know, LeBron's way, at the very least, seems like he's doing a lot of positive good.
It's a great point you make, and I think it's the most important point, that not only is he involved in the political process, he's really focused on maybe the central issue, which is, you know, you can't claw back people's ability to vote. Like, that's really where all the change is going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, it's either going to happen with bricks and broken store windows, or it's going to happen at the ballot box, and probably some combination of the two. He's doing something really smart. And of course, I was thinking about how, you remember back when we were at OTR and the NBA shut down and there was the labor battle between the league under Stern and the players?
And
at the time, it was the superstars who really broke it up because it was in their financial interest to get playing again. And the rank and file kind of got hosed. I felt like just even zooming, like eavesdropping secondhand over the Zoom call, I kind of felt like in this, the rank and file are going to have a lot more say than they usually do. And that really interested me.
Yeah. Well, obviously very different situations. I mean, that's Captain Obvious by me. This one, because this one is now, that last one was just about money, which is very emotional. But this one is about money. And this is also about protest and social inequality and police brutality. So it adds so many other layers to this discussion. And the good thing is for the NBA, at least they've set it up. They've said, if you don't want to go, if you are uncomfortable, you're not going to be punished. You're not going to be fined. We respect it. We'll find ways to fill your spot. You're not going to get paid, but there was only like 15% of the season, 20% of the season left. They've set it up where it's like, if you want to go, hey, do what you think is best.
I was really moved by what Kyrie was saying and Dwight Howard. It's funny, like all these guys who sort of have had asterisks next to their name for being problematic have been really interesting. Well, not all, but I mean, even Carmelo, like there's a lot of people that you would maybe write off as being bad teammates. They've had a lot of interesting things to say. But I thought about this myself and I thought, could I avoid the NBA playing being a distraction? I think it would be hard, especially for those of us who really love basketball. Like there's this feeling that we just want normal life to return so badly. And that's not just the Black Lives Matters discussion that have been, you know, obviously have forced everybody to reanalyze everything. But I think this idea of normal life is kind of a bad one in a lot of ways. Like we've been forced to in some ways, it's the most natural instinct to want to go back to a place of peace. But yes. Then we've been forced to examine the fact that this place of peace wasn't really that. It was a bit of an illusion. So when these guys are saying, do we need to rip it all down because we don't want to get sucked back into the false narratives? It's a really good point.
It is. Yeah, there's no arguing against it. And we all are seduced about just wanting sports to go back. But, you know, hopefully if sports do and they're playing, well, at the end of games, there's going to be a microphone. There's going to be tell us what happened. And, you know, you can use players can use that platform to talk about defensive rebounds and where they are now with why was there a long lineup in this poor neighborhood in Atlanta versus this rich neighborhood. There was no lineup at all. Can we have some investigating and then maybe more media spotlight goes there? And, you know, you can use this platform for good, but I fully understand the concern that we're all just going to ease back into the way things were.
The politician, the Twitter follow for anyone who's interested in this stuff, you might want to check out Stacey Abrams, who is an American politician, and she has been really, really active over the last couple of years on voter rights and making sure there is no voter suppression. That should be the most platform agnostic message of all. Like whether you're on the right side or the left side, I would like to believe everyone would say, let's make voting as easy as possible. It doesn't seem to be the case, but that should be the easiest thing in the world to organize around. Let's make sure everybody can vote.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I agree.
Is Rick Westhead, like, officially the Woodward and Bernstein of TSN now?
Oh, absolutely. Like, the joke we make is that if Westhead is calling you up because he wants to interview you, you're either doing something really good or really bad. There is no middle ground.
He's got that Mike Wallace thing, which is, sir, Mr. Wallace is on hold for you. Tell him I'm out.
Yeah, exactly. Or you walk into my favorite one, you walk into the kitchen because you're now going on a date. And I think, was it Chris Hansen? Who was it? It was like, oh, to catch a Predator host. He's like, oh, why don't you sit down for a second?
Yeah, well, and Bill Hader played him, right? What was his name?
Yes.
No,
I think it was a Chris
guy. No, was it that guy that you're talking about?
You know, what is that? Or one of those scary on Saturday night real crime TV shows. But the bigger point is, is that when Rick Westhead is on the line, you better make sure your ducks are in a row.
Honestly, if you've done something bad and you know you've done something bad and an investigative journalist calls you up and says, I just want to sit down with some cameras and chat. Mm-hmm. What kind of idiot says, okay?
Arrogance, hubris. I'm fine. I can get like, it's the same arrogance when, when the baseball owners are like, I don't need to listen to PR. I got this. Hey, public, we're losing money. It's like, no one believes you. Listen to your PR team. Shut up. Don't roll up your sleeves and say, I got this, Poindexter. I don't need your psychology degree.
We should call this the James Dolan dilemma. Like, it should be something that they teach in universities and just use him as a study of guy who doesn't get it.
Yeah, don't do what Dolan does.
Don't do what Dolan don't does.
Yeah, I'd rip it off the Simpsons.
So the reason I mentioned Rick Westhead is because he's investigating the GTHL, the Greater Toronto Hockey League, as to reports on on-ice racism and how it's chosen to sort of monitor itself. And it was interesting because, again, they tried to get away with what we were saying, which is the we don't want to talk about it. which I guess they discovered they couldn't do, and now they've released it. The figures, I haven't really gone over them enough to have an intelligent point of view, except to say they seem kind of low, and even the league admitted they seem kind of low, and it was only on stuff that refs would actually report, not necessarily on ice instances of things that actually happened.
Yeah.
You know, I was thinking about this, Matt, how we look to other leagues for guidance, but in Canada, we're a hockey country first and foremost, and how hard it is to look to hockey for anything, and how kind of starved we've been. Like, there's some pretty interesting people in the NHL, Jonathan Taves, Patrice Bergeron, like there's some pretty interesting voices. But once again, it just goes back to how hard it is to look to hockey for anything other than pucks in deep.
Well, again, the conservative nature of it, that let's just keep things the way they are. And the problem with the GTHL is if the numbers are low, it's because there is sort of that code that, you don't go outside of the locker room and spill any of the dirty secrets. And, you know, for the GTHL, the idea of, we're not going to talk about it right now, that doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's like transparency is needed, and things are going to be a little bit ugly. They're going to be a whole lot ugly, but it's better just to be honest and go, here's all of our problems, versus to try to hide it. Because as always, the cover-up is often as bad, sometimes even worse than the crime.
It's a great point. And like, we both love hockey. I grew up playing it. And I actually tried to think, like, so I played organized hockey for about 6 years as a kid before I was just too lousy. I was a better baseball player. I just focused on that. But let's say for six seasons I played, I can't remember one black teammate. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't remember one. And it's not like the neighborhood I grew up in Toronto didn't have black people in it. You know, it's just, it's always been such a homogenized world. Like, it's, I'd love to see it addressed. And it was interesting too, in the GTL report, about how gender was actually the sort of was the thing that was most often referenced on ice things that wound up being punished. It was
right.
That should be a no-brainer to fix. You know, like, honestly, the fact that we've, I don't know, there's all these ongoing conversations, and you sit there and you think, like, how is this even a conversation at this point, you know?
The first answer is it starts at the home. It starts with, you know, like, if it's kids saying bad things, it's up to the parents to be like, I'm taking you out. You know, we're not going to have you say, you know, these horror, you know, like the racist or as you mentioned, the gender stuff. It has to start there. And then it's up to these leagues to go, if there's evidence of your kid or if someone in the stands, you know, there's going to be harsh punishment.
So I want to offer this out just as a constructive criticism towards TSN and Sportsnet and anybody else who's covering hockey in the mainstream media.
Yeah.
You know, let women be analysts. You know, it's amazing to me that there's all this hockey coverage. You know, Cassie Campbell-Pascal is outstanding and should have a much bigger platform. But the fact is, like, it's all white dudes. It's white dudes in suits. Honestly, it looks like a board meeting at an accounting firm, all of these sets. Like, just hire somebody, you know, just do it.
Because if you do it, then it starts the trickle-down effect of, if you're young and you see someone that looks like you, then that can inspire you to go down that road versus another road.
Well, you know, I have a friend who on Twitter made a really great point about white supremacy. And he said, it doesn't mean, like, he's an Indigenous fellow. And he said, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to hate my guts in order to sort of be a party to this. He said, it just means that you have to prioritize white values or experiences above other ones. And I thought that was a really important way to phrase it, because I think a lot of us sort of brush off claims of white supremacy because we think of, like, skinhead idiots with no shirts on running around with baseball bats and swastikas, right?
Yeah.
Which is, of course, the most violent and extreme expression of white supremacy. But his point was, it really just means that you think that white culture is more important. And the best way to make sure that doesn't happen is don't do it.
Yeah. And it, you know, like, on the hockey side, it's almost like you've got to attack it with sort of like a pincer attack. On one end, it starts at the grassroots level, doing what you can so that you get more and more people that aren't white into hockey. And then at the top level, it's making sure there is enough voices and faces of, you know, just that sort of diversity so that you can see at the top level, there are people that represent you. So it's like a two-front attack to deal with something like this.
I came across this quote from the filmmaker Jean-Luc Godard, whom I like very much. And
of course
this really,
you did.
Of course I did. That is also on brand. You're a badminton player, and I was cruising French cinema Twitter. But he had a quote, which I think is a good way to move forward. And he said, like in 2013, it's not enough to make political films. You have to make them politically. And that really hit me, you know? It's not enough to make political content right now. We have to make them politically.
Staying on that subject, but 180 degree in terms of the tone.
Sure.
Remember the time, Bob, I made you delete a retweet and it was some sort of French cinema thing, but it was a classy nude and you like retweeted it on your Twitter account. I'm like, Bob, this was many, many years ago. And for you, it was something artistic. I'm like, I think that's a bare bottom.
it was like some French art film, and I tweeted out something like, I think I retweeted like, hey, what a great film, and you were like, dummy.
Yeah.
Well, that was, you know what, that was my head up my academy ass right there.
It really was. It was great.
Hey, I got a couple sports questions for you outside of the political spectrum.
Sure.
Austin Martin, can we just like, I've been thinking about how I want to talk about the Jays and think about the Jays, because they might not even play in Toronto this summer. Fair to say?
They might not play.
Great. So is 2022 now circle the date?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Like you've seen people tweeting out what the 2022 roster would be with all the young position talent. And I think was it Nate Pearson? So yeah, it's basically like to wake me up and you got to hibernate. All Jays fans, just hibernate to 2022.
You know, that PA Parento season under Babcock, where they were 30th.
Yeah.
They lost a lot of one-goal games.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do that next summer. I could do it, you know.
Yeah, even.
I just got excited about the idea of another Toronto athlete who could be great named Austin.
It's a great name. It's like, it's such a, I mean, how can this guy fail? You know, it's with a name like Austin Martin. This guy has to be a success. And when I talked about him on Thursday, I prefaced it. I know nothing about him. So here's what smart people have said about him going into the draft. And then I read a tweet from a guy, I think named Gary, who lives in Florida and says, I have friends who played college ball against him. I'm like, great, Gary. You know more than I do about this fella. And it seemed everyone was happy with the pick.
I read one article and one expert said Mookie Betts.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one said Ben Zobrist. And I thought to myself,
I'm fine with either of those.
Yeah, I'm good with either, but that's too wide a range. Like, I love Ben Zobrist. He's not Mookie Betts.
No.
I've been pretty happy with either, though. Ben Zobrist, nice piece.
Oh, yeah. Ben Zobrist, he was always that glue guy. He was always, this guy does so many different things to help you win.
You know, like, he was one of those guys, like, when you really love baseball, you love him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Actually, that would be a good top five for us. Top five athletes in each sport that when you love the sport, this is who you love.
Oh, yeah. This is your, I know a lot about sport X because I'm the one who loves player Y. You know, it's like, oh, you might love, oh, sure, we all love Manny Ramirez. But you know what? Ben Zobrist really is the guy who makes a difference.
Remember when we all loved Matt Barnes in the NBA?
Yes.
100%. Brings that scrappy perimeter defense.
Yep. Same thing about Shane Battier until Michael Lewis ruined it by writing an article and normalized analytics.
I'm trying to think who's, you know what? There's a million examples of this with hockey. And the problem is that all, like, nobody is an undiscovered gem for very long. I remember Louis Erickson was like the world's most underrated player until he said it so many times he became overrated.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's like, if he's so great, why does he keep getting traded? Here's a good football example. And I actually said this on air on the Monday after the Super Bowl. I'm like, everyone's talking about Patrick Mahomes. The best player on the field was Chris Jones, the defensive tackle for the Chiefs who like knocked down three Garoppolo passes. You know, so that was my version.
You know, there's something so great about the sports fan. Again, it's like me and my French cinema. the sports fan who just has to know a little bit more about how the game was really won.
Yeah. It's fun. And you know how they start their conversations with that?
Mm.
With two words.
Mm.
Well, actually.
You know, if we were on the radio, I think this would have been the birth of a new segment called Well, Actually.
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely. You pause. Well, actually, you make your sentence and then you just have that little smug sniff at the end.
I feel like that would probably be done in my voice. Raptors, 1 year ago today, NBA.
Yeah. Team. Yep. Where were you?
I was at home and we were in the basement and they won and I started yelling and Charlotte was still up.
Of course
she was. And she's never seen me lose my composure to that degree before. And we were all cheering. And then she kind of just stopped and stared at me. And I noticed her looking. And she went, Dad, what are you doing?
Well,
where were you?
Well, first on that one, and we'll go on a deeper little tangent for a second. You can tell me if I'm right or wrong because I don't have kids. But I think one of the biggest things for a parent is to always show their kid they're in control. Like even more, if mom and dad fight, that stinks. But I think what scares kids more is if mom or dad is like, I don't know. I don't have any answers. I'm out of control. Now, not what you were doing. You were just enjoying the moment. But I think it's one thing that kids keep an eye on. They want to know that mom and dad might be a little nuts, but mom and dad still know how to steer the ship.
Matt, what you say is one of the hardest things for parents, at least in my experience and certainly in my own. Yeah. One of the hardest things for parents to try to figure out is what's the balance between teaching kids it's okay to have emotions and having emotions?
Yeah, that's true.
It's a very complicated thing. Maybe we should get into a parenting pod at some point. You can just ask me random questions as the world's preeminent uncle.
Mm-hmm. And then I'll be that asshole that goes, who even though he doesn't have kids. Well, actually, how you should raise your kid, Bob, is like this.
Honestly, Matt, how are we not doing this bit? Come on, that's it. Next week we're going to do Well, Actually.
Sure, I'll get some Well, Actuallys.
You've heard of Love Actually? This is Well, Actually.
Oh, so good. But getting back to the Raptor thing, I was working. I was doing the pre halftime and post with Jim Taddy, and the problem was Game 6 was on the Fan, so we went on air when there was about a minute left in the game. And the problem is we were not allowed. It's this thing. You're not allowed to do play by play. So we're trying to dance around what's going on. And as we are on air live, Danny Green decided to throw the ball to Golden State because he wanted to make it interesting. I remember wanting to swear live on air. And I just looked at Jim and I went, it seems to me, Jim, as I'm gritting my teeth, that Danny Green has elected to give Golden State one more possession. This feels like an odd strategy.
Somebody needs to get the audio of this conversation.
Oh my God. I was livid, and Jim far more professional than I am. But I was in the studio. I brought a nice bottle of Ontario, of a sparkling from Henry Appellum. I'm like, if they win, everyone in the studio in the control room, I'll pour everyone like a little half glass and we'll celebrate with a good Canadian sparkling as our Canadian team won it all.
So was it the greatest sports moment of your life when they won?
I don't know. It's in the top three.
It wasn't
mine. I always go back to the 92 Blue Jays because that was the first one. And, you know, there hadn't been a championship in ages in this city. Not that there had been after the Raptors won, for bleep's sake. It's right at the top, but I might have a special spot for the 1992 Blue Jays. And I don't mean that as a, well, actually, you know, sort of thing.
I think one of the things that a great sports moment has to have is an ultimate reversal of the decision. Like something conclusively has to be decided and it could have gone either way. The golden goal, for example. If they had won in regulation and it had been in an exciting last minute, you know, that's amazing, but it's not the golden goal where
yeah.
it was in doubt, and then suddenly there was a turn. You know, Jose Bautista's home run, Robbie Alomar's home run, Joe Carter's home run. Baseball's perfect for this, especially if you've got the last at bat. And the fact that Joe Carter hit that home run, it was the first time a World Series had ever been decided by a walk-off home run.
Yeah.
You know, like that's got those Robbie Thompson shot heard around the world kind of overtones. And really, when it comes to the Raptors' run, the Kawhi 4 bouncer that drops against Philly, like that was the moment, if you want to talk about moments. The fact that they won was the most satisfying win, I think. But for moments, it was definitely the shot against Philly.
Because there's a finality there. And if the Raptors had lost, they still could go home to Toronto for game 7. And as you remember, there was so much like replay going on. The last 30 seconds took like 5 minutes. So we had this, can we celebrate? We want to celebrate. And then the finale of the Raptors winning it all was more of a official declaration of, yeah, you can celebrate now.
Is it weird when you see Kawhi celebrating now? When you think about all that happened with the chasing him to try and sign him in free agency, the last minute reversal and headed to LA, CP24 chasing him as he's going down the street with aerial cameras. Yeah. Is it weird now after all of that to see that footage and think, man, it really happened and he was really here? I had the experience where it was kind of weird looking at that footage today.
It's like looking at, you find it an old picture of you and a girlfriend, but it was a summer fling. It was crazy. It was intense. But by week one of the NFL season, it was over. And you look back and it's almost like you don't recognize, you recognize yourself, but you don't recognize the two of you together.
It's a really good way to put it. And those are people you don't follow on Facebook, right?
No. But I don't really do much on Facebook. But yeah, don't follow your exes if you're going to go down those little memory rabbit holes. They don't help.
You know what I kind of learned? Like, I thought a lot today before we did the pod about, was there anything in the last year that changed for me in my perspective of that team or that organization? And I actually think the biggest one for me, like the biggest reversal, was my vision of Nick Nurse. Mm-hmm. You know, I really liked Dwayne Casey, and I still think Dwayne Casey's a good NBA coach.
Yes.
But Nick Nurse was a better coach than Dwayne Casey.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can give you one specific moment. We were interviewing him for TSN for this like up close and unfiltered thing with fans. So all the hosts, you know, got to ask him a question. And one that came up was about Fred VanVleet. And like, how did you turn Fred VanVleet around? And he's like, well, we moved him a foot further behind the three-point line. And we said, shoot from this spot versus this spot, because defenses are waiting for you over here. And it was just some simple, smart coaching, and it made such a difference.
It's such a great point, Matt. And I love that you shared that, because the way that players are used, sometimes even just tiny things at this level can make a huge difference. I remember Andrew Berkshire, who writes for The Athletic, covering the Habs, back when PK was a Hab, and he talked about how PK was being encouraged to sag back a little bit off the blue line on the power play, as opposed to maybe stepping up, and just how the extra distance changed his shot and the effectiveness of his shot off the point. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of thing as a fan I probably never would have noticed. But it makes total sense. And everyone was decrying the fact that PK's effectiveness off the point wasn't as great as it had been in the past. But they had marginally changed his usage. And that had an effect. And that's, I think, we talk a lot about how players, they know how to play at this point, but the way you deploy them, that's really the art of coaching at that level. When you have those magnificent athletes to work with, is what are those micro utilizations that change, you know, defeat into victory? It's a great point, Matt.
Yeah. And another one real quick. You know, there was a lot of talk last month about Roy Halladay on the anniversary of him throwing the perfect game, the documentary that came out on him, that Mel Queen, it's like, okay, we're gonna sidearm you a little bit on your delivery. And, you know, they did that change, and he went from a guy with an ERA of 10 to like 2 years later winning the Cy Young.
I'm looking at video today of CJ Van Eck, because of course I was. And I'm looking at his 12-6 curveball, and I'm thinking, oh, that's a nice pitch. And how Keith Law says he's got, as Keith Law, of course, does, a triptych of quality pitches. And his fastball hits 91 to 95. And I thought, but none of this matters. Like, there's guys with great stuff who don't succeed all the time because it's about these tiny adjustments. Baseball is killer for that, though, because everything is so small in scale, like a swing with a tiny little hitch is the difference between hitting 240 and 280.
And it's a two-way streak. The player has got to want to be coached and have the humility to say, yes, change some things that worked for me great for the last decade. And then you've got to have smart coaches who can implement it. So it takes both sides.
There was a moment that somebody who's close to the team relayed to me about that championship season and how Kyle Lowry, we famously talk about how Masai Ujiri sat him down and kind of set him right. But it was actually during a practice, as the story was told to me, that Kyle Lowry was, he either stormed off or was ready to storm off. And it was Kawhi Leonard who pulled him aside and said, look, like, we got a year to do this. And I need you out there. And you got to be a grown-up about this and a professional. And you can't do that anymore. I don't know that side of Kawhi was ever really put out there. I was kind of shocked to hear the story because I always thought it was not that he was a passenger here, because he's obviously a really intense player and, you know, left it out on the court. But I never thought of him as a leader behind the scenes. Maybe that's another thing that I was forced to reconsider, was that maybe Kawhi behind the scenes wasn't the flake that we thought he was.
Yeah, well, you just didn't think, oh, is Kawhi going to take this personal? And by doing that with Lowry, he did. And then also good on Lowry for the reflection going, yep, okay, you're right. I got to, you know, instead of externalizing my problems, I got to internalize here.
It's funny when you think about athletes not being supremely focused all the time, because one, they're paid an enormous amount of money to do it. But two, how could you possibly get to that level without being extremely focused all the time? But when Jokic walked into camp and he looks like he's dropped, what, 20 pounds?
Yeah.
Maybe even more? I got scared. I started thinking, wow, how good is Denver if he's even better? Is he going to be Giannis?
Hey, Marc Gasol has gotten great shape. So if you're Joel Embiid, you better hit the elliptical. And Kyle Lowry, I saw a shot of him, and he looked pretty cut as well. So, you know, it's so funny now, like, getting ready for the NBA season, you just start combing through Instagram. It's almost like you're peeping Tomming on the Raptors to see what sort of shape they're in.
That's funny. It's the NBA thirst trap, as you're just trying to find, like, who looks buff.
Yeah. I learned thirst trap just the other day. I had no idea what that term meant.
I learned it a while ago because I worked with a lot of younger interns, and I believe I may have referred to it at some point as a thirsty trap.
And they just looked at you. Okay, old man.
In the spirit of the caretaker at the Overlook Hotel, they corrected me.
Did you know,
today's the 40th anniversary of the release of The Shining.
What?
Yep.
How did we do that 41 minutes into this podcast?
I don't know, because I forgot. And then I just mentioned it now, but I saw it this morning. Sent a tweet to all my friends, which, you know, not you, Matt, but other friends.
Yeah.
Which in theory, like a picture of two kids lying there, like, you know, after an axe murderer, probably in most other contexts would seem kind of ghoulish, but in this one seemed kind of celebratory.
Oh, yeah. Nice job, Dad.
That movie's disturbing.
Also, it's always my favorite analogy for why Canadian hockey teams never win the Stanley Cup, because something happens when you're the owners or GMs and on Canadian teams, there's a little more pressure. There's something about, we got to win here in Canada. And it's just, you know, there's something about the soil, something about the geography. Just like being the caretaker at the Overlook, it's going to end bad. Same thing. If you're the owner or GM of a hockey team and the soil is north of the 49th, it just does things to you.
Also the tax laws.
Also the tax laws and the Canadian dollar. Yeah, there's several other things as well.
So since we're talking about movies, do you want to do some AMC questions before we wrap up? I don't want to do the Tom Cruise one or the franchise one, because I felt like that was you struggling with AMC's programming to come up with questions.
I can get some of the other ones that I've done this week. And by the way, well, they play Karate Kid so many times.
Why don't you put Ralph Macchio on the show? He's a hockey fan.
Ooh, that'd be hilarious. That's a great idea.
Just call him up.
Yeah.
And, you know, talk about the AMC thing and let him know that, you know, he'll hear your voice, man. He'll know you're one of them. You're one of us.
Yeah. So it's a great idea. There was your favorite submarine movies where a submarine is prominently featured. That was Monday.
Can you do that one? I'm interested in that. I realized that the submarine movie is a bit of a blind spot in my movie going viewing.
All right. Well, I'll throw out my three honorable mentions, and if you can, you can comment as you see fit, or as you like to say, correct me. douchebag. Yellow Submarine, The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, and The Abyss.
They were all on my list. Mm-hmm. Okay, go for it.
My top five, at number five, Das Boot, because I don't want to look like a dummy. Mm-hmm. My number four, The Spy Who Loved Me, because that white car transforms into a submarine that was so cool that Elon Musk bought the same car, bought the actual car for over 600,000 pounds in 2013.
Something tells me that was internet research.
It was. Number three, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Number two, The Hunt for Red October. And then number one, Ghost, Quentin Tarantino did some script punch-ups for it. It's Denzel versus Gene Hackman. It's Crimson Tide.
It's a really good list. And we've got an awful lot of overlap. I got 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, Yellow Submarine, Red October, The Abyss, and The Life Aquatic.
Yeah.
I didn't put Das Boot because I didn't want to be a phony. I saw it a long time ago, and I don't really remember it that well. I remember it being quite glum.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Bob, a three-hour black-and-white movie about a bunch of Nazis in a submarine, that's hard to be a toe-tap-and-feel-good movie.
I've seen some submarine war movies, but I couldn't even remember the title of them. It's just that, you know, there were lots of days over my life where I just lie in front of Turner Classic Movies and don't change the channel.
Yeah.
But I don't think it really made that big an impact. The one that really jumped out at me from this list, though, was The Abyss.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I can't remember. Like, I need to watch it again. But I seem to remember it's pretty darn underrated. Am I right?
You're absolutely right. The, like, before we saw the technology of, like,
CGI?
Jurassic Park or Terminator, the CGI stuff, the first time you really saw it mainstream was in The Abyss. That movie got buried a little bit. It's really good.
When Ed Harris is tumbling and he's trying to send the little text messages on his armband, it's heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah. And it has the ultimate, is this person going to die? Did they drown? And you're pumping their chest, and then right. You're using those electric devices, the clear, like that's the definitive of those scenes.
I remember hearing a film critic at the time saying the biggest problem with The Abyss in terms of gaining a wide audience was the name. And they actually went and did something where they polled people coming out of the theater what an abyss was. And the most popular answer was an adventure.
Yeah, you're right. It's not a good name. It's like Edge of Tomorrow. They switched it to Live, Die, and Repeat.
What?
Yeah, the Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, Edge of Tomorrow.
Underrated movie.
Oh, I love that movie. And then, sorry, I didn't want to try to snake us into a Tom Cruise conversation. But the sequel is Live, Die, and Repeat. And then after the movie came out, part of the marketing wing of the movie, you would find posters and stuff. The exact same poster, just with that other name.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting. Speaking of Emily Blunt, I read recently that she was the original casting choice for the Black Widow character in the Avengers, but she couldn't do it because of scheduling, and so it went to Scarlett Johansson. That's a missed opportunity. Wouldn't Emily Blunt have been an amazing Black Widow?
Yeah, she would have been. She would have been.
Fine. No, she's fine. She's good.
I think Scarlett did a good job. I think Blunt would have potential to have done a better job.
I think Scarlett Johansson was like a tier B performance if you think like tier A is Hemsworth and Ruffalo and Downey. I really like Elizabeth Olsen too. I think she's super underrated as Scarlet Witch. They didn't use her a ton, but both her and Vision I thought were really good. I'm excited to see WandaVision.
Yes.
Oh God, we're nerding out so much.
We really are.
Let's do vampire movies and then call it a day.
Done and done. I discovered
movies, buddy.
Yeah, and I have to say, my vampire list, there's a lot of great vampire movies I realize I haven't seen. It's a blind spot for me. So my top five, this list, not as impressive as the other one. At number five, Fright Night. At number four, the 86 version. Number four, Lost Boys. Number three, Interview with the Vampire. Number two, Dusk Till Dawn. And at number one, super creepy, Salem's Lot. Apologies, Bram Stoker's Dracula, but Keanu ruined that movie.
Okay, so let's pick it up there because it's on my almost list. It's not, it's almost like there's two different movies and one of them sucks and one of them is amazing.
Yeah.
Like there's the Gary Oldman, Francis Ford Coppola, sort of Anthony Hopkins movie, which is brilliant. And then there's the Keanu Reeves, Winona Ryder, also Francis Ford Coppola movie. And that one sucks.
Yep.
It's like Anthony Hopkins is almost stuck in the middle. He can't tell if this is like an art piece or if it's kitsch.
Love to ask Hopkins, you know, what was he thinking? And like, what was he thinking when he was doing it? And what was he thinking when he saw it for the first time in its completed form?
I got to believe Francis Ford Coppola was probably thinking cash grab.
Yeah.
Just, you know, make a big honking Hollywood movie. It made a ton of dough. I think it's underrated because the good stuff is really good, but the bad stuff's pretty hokey.
Yeah.
It's a good movie. I've watched it recently, like within the last year, and I found myself, you know, it's like in almost 10 minute intervals going from really, really engaged to kind of almost cringing. Yeah. Weird. I'm going to throw out just another couple of ones here. And one of the things that's interesting about vampire movies is the original Bram's, like the Dracula going back
to Nosferatu.
Well, not that one. That one I'll talk about in a second, but the Bela Lugosi one, it's not that good a movie. Like I've seen it and it pales in comparison to Frankenstein or even The Mummy or The Invisible Man. Like of all those Universal Monster movies, it feels like the most successful villain was Dracula, but the least successful movie was Dracula. You should watch it
again. That makes sense.
It doesn't really age that well. And it's not, I don't know. There's other better Dracula movies. The 1922 Nosferatu, the Murnau film. That's incredible. That movie's brilliant. Like, I still find it scary. And it's a 1922 black and white movie. The Only Lovers Left Alive by Jim Jarmusch is really good.
I've heard.
Highly recommend it. It's almost like if you could imagine, you know those Ethan Hawke, Julie Delpy movies?
Yeah.
Imagine one of those but with vampires.
Oh, okay. I'm down for that.
Speaking of different takes, What We Do in the Shadows, the Taika Waititi movie.
Yeah, I got to see that as well because my love of Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah, he's just a really interesting talent and everything he does is interesting. An amazing concept, a good movie, but an amazing concept is 30 Days of Night. Have you ever seen it?
I haven't. I've tried to get Amy to watch it, and she always says no, so I got to wait till she's not around, which is harder now when you're unemployed.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool idea. It's a very cool idea, actually. It was based on a graphic novel, and the idea is it's vampires in the far north where the sun almost never rises, so it's literally, like, for this 1 month, pretty much night all the time, and some humans who have to try to survive it, and there's no help coming. Like, it's just... It's a great idea. There's a really scary movie called Let the Right One In, which is a Scandinavian film, which is really good. And I don't know how I feel about Interview with a Vampire. I kind of wish it was better than it was. I feel like almost like Justice League, you know, the Scott Snyder Justice League. It feels like there's probably a better movie in there that didn't get made.
Mm-hmm.
Vampires are such a great villain, though, because of the charm. Like, there's two kinds of monsters. There's the seducing monster, and then there's the grotesque monster. And Dracula is kind of like the king of the seducing monster.
Yeah, and there's pathos there.
Well, especially when if you consider the legacy to be like the Francis Ford Coppola side of things, where there was an aristocrat whose life is shattered, and he makes the unholy alliance and becomes the undead.
Yep,
it's a bit of a Faustian bargain.
Ah, oh, you beat me to it, Bob. You beat me to Faustian. And then I was thinking, do I go Mephistopheles? What do I do here?
Do you want to just take it?
No, you got there first.
Yeah, it's true. But you were thinking it.
Yeah, I was now Faust, must thou needs be damned? Oh.
One of the problems that vampire movies have right now is that after Twilight and just so many different vampire concepts that they don't feel scary. It's kind of like zombies that way where familiarity breeds boredom.
Yeah, it's true. All these shows, it's just like 22-year-olds with great abs and mopey eyes.
I remember Taylor Lautner, who was the werewolf character in the Twilight movies.
Sure.
Talking about how he had an 8-pack abs. And I was thinking, like, not only do I not have a 6-pack, but you added more abs to have.
He was body shaming you, Bob.
I think it was, it wasn't a hard goal to accomplish.
No. All right, Bob. I think that's a good spot to end it. I hope you have it's great chatting. Hope you have a great weekend. And I hope your daughter, I hope she has some more, you know, safe social distancing, you know, parties or moments or get-togethers with a friend. And then as all the parents watch to go, oh, no, they're going to touch each other. Oh, no, what do we do?
Matt, she's going to get to hug her aunt this weekend. She loves her aunt like a second mom. And I think I'm probably going to cry.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. Okay, Maddie, great to catch up with you. We'll talk early next week.
Yeah.
Monday or Tuesday.
We will talk early next week, Bob. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, pal. See you later.
See you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to the Macko and Cause podcast. Remember to subscribe on iTunes or Audioboom. And if you like the podcast, leave a review. If you don't like the podcast, then maybe don't leave a review.